from KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, the science writer Brian Switek says, "For too long, we saw dinosaurs as prehistoric sideshow freaks. For decades, the creatures were portrayed as lumbering, scaly, clumsy hulks who were destined to go extinct. But the more we learn, the more we see the real animals were not what we thought. Switek says they were more dynamic, more agile, and less scaly. Turns out they could be fuzzy. Switek writes that the dinosaurs we're bringing to life today are far more beautiful and complex than their earlier incarnations. And he says they're not just icons of extinction. He calls them prominent players in evolution, enough to raise questions about our own place in nature." Brian Switek is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called My Beloved Brontosaurus. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his latest book, the science journalist Brian Switek writes about his favorite dinosaur. But he says, pick any dinosaur you like, and you'll learn that those ancient creatures are an undeniable proof about the history of our planet. A history, he writes, that is so deep it's hard to comprehend. A history where, he says, life has changed dramatically. In the book, he writes about how our pop culture images of the dinosaurs are changing the more we learn. So they weren't these scaly, clumsy beasts that we thought they were. They were far more complex, far more dynamic. And our history is not separate from them either. Switek writes about how during the millions of years when dinosaurs reigned, the very earliest version of humans, small mammals, were evolving in the shadows. So without them, we would not be what we are. Today in the program, Brian Switek is joining us to talk about his book. It's called My Beloved Brontosaurus. Brian Switek is an online columnist for National Geographic. His writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal and Wired and Scientific American and the journal Nature. He's the author of two books, Written in Stone, Evolution, Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. And as I mentioned, this latest, My Beloved Brontosaurus. Here's the full title, My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. And Brian Switek, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be back.
So I guess I wanted to start with because you write about this. Let me start with the first day of nursery school because you've talked about this. And you say that you drew – I think you drew a whale and then you may have drawn some other big creature. And I was – and you've also talked about how you used to play with you know, you watched documentaries. You played with with dinosaur toys. You read books about – I mean you were nuts about it. And you say that any weird animal sparked your imagination. So the question is, do you think you understand what it was about that? Was it that they were mysterious, that they were from the past, or was it they were big? What do you know?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to put myself back in my five-year-old sort of imagination. But I think it was sort of a combination of many of those things, that they were totally bizarre, that there's nothing quite like them alive. Like think about something like Stegosaurus, this sort of, you know, just – hill of plates and spikes with this tiny little head on these long legs, you know, lumbering around. There's nothing like that. And the fact that that was real, this is not a dragon, this is not a monster, this is not Godzilla, this is you know, an animal that really existed 150 million years ago. And just thinking about that span of time, like how much must have changed since then, what this animal looked like, what its habitat was like, you know, when you know, it's that phrase when dinosaurs ruled the earth, to think about when our own planet was almost, you know, alien to us. I think that's what really grabbed my imagination, that, you know, these were real animals that were completely monstrous.
You know, what I wondered about, you know, you're such a, you know, you're such a clear thinker. You're a skeptic. You're not interested. I mean, you're interested in how myths play out, but
that's
it frustrates you that people buy into a lot of this, obviously. So I thought about this idea that they were these fantastic creatures, you could see them as mythological creatures. But I always saw that Brian liked them because they were real. that there was nothing fakey about them, that they were – that was appealing about it. Is that part of it?
I certainly think so. That, you know, that, like I said, that they were real animals and that people have been sort of wondering about them for centuries. I mean, before there was science, before, you know, we had a name for what dinosaurs were. I mean, the word dinosaur is only coined in 1842.
Yeah.
People were finding their bones. And geohistorians like Adrienne Mayer in some of her books, you know, she's tracked how myths and legends are attached to fossil sites. So when people would find the bones of Protoceratops, like if you took a Triceratops, shrunk it down, took off its horns, made about the size of a German shepherd or so, this small horned dinosaur, people would find their bones in Mongolia, in the Gobi Desert. And if you didn't know that, you know, what a Protoceratops was or what a dinosaur was, and you came across bones like this, that you know they were real bones, but they didn't match any animal that, you know, what would you do? And what people of the time did, they basically conjured up the myth of the griffin. If you go back to the earliest depictions of what a griffin is, it looks very, very much like a Protoceratops, and it sort of, you know, continued to evolve from there. So, you know, there's myths and legends wrapped up with dinosaurs. But like you said, the amazing thing is, and what really gets me even now, I think like last time I was on here, you know, we talked about Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and a lot of things like that. You know, that's all cool. But the amazing thing is that their real animals are even more fantastic than that. That reality is stranger than any fiction that we can bring up. And I think that's a major, you know, even to this day, major appeal of dinosaurs for me.
Let's talk about the title Brontosaurus, because there's obviously a bit of tongue-in-cheek in there and a little bit of irony, because there's no such thing, or – although that's complicated too, which we'll get
certainly,
to.
Yes.
Right? But you went – this was 1988. You mm-hmm. write about this. You went to the American Museum of Natural History in New York for the first time. And there you saw the Brontosaurus
that's
mound.
Right.
That's what they called it then. Did they call it then?
Yes, yeah. It was. Yeah.
The older you got, you realized how – screwed up that was and how wrong that might have been, but you were sucked in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, I don't really even remember my parents being there. I was 5 years old at the time, and I remember taking, you know, the elevator up, and this was in the old Hall of Jurassic Dinosaurs. So the skeletons, the real bones are still there, but now they're all, you know, anatomically, you know, proper and in these airy, you know, sort of open, lighted halls. Back then it was, you know, dark and dusty and dingy, just the way that I like it.
Right.
I love my museums that way. It's very moody. And just seeing this long-necked, heavy-bodied, tail-dragging dinosaur is just absolutely gigantic. It was something, you know, I'd seen pictures, I'd seen the movies, I'd seen documentaries. But to be there in the presence of the animal itself, to see the authentic bones, to see the, you know, the bones that were inside a living animal, I couldn't help but think of, you know, especially what the animal sounded like. I tried to imagine, you know, what would – even just the sound of its breathing, you know, just walking across this sort of Jurassic – plains. It was almost like, you know, there's a dinosaur ghost there, you know, in the hall. I was already a dinosaur nut, but that really made it a permanent part of my life.
This is how you put it in the book. You said you didn't see dead dinosaurs. You didn't see dead dinosaurs. You say you saw the osteological architecture of creatures that might walk again. What do you mean?
Well, skeletons are beautiful things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that's you can take something that's familiar, like a horse or, you know, even a cat, and then you see their skeletons inside. And that's evolution and anatomy all wrapped up in a beautiful sort of package. But to me, I was trying to imagine sort of flesh on the bones.
Yeah.
So from the feet up, sort of, you know, if – you know, I could conjure up these animals again. I could in my imagination. But in real life, if I could conjure them up again, what they might actually look like just before they sort of ducked out of the museum and walked out to Central Park West. And that's the wonderful thing about paleontology. It's where science and imagination meet. That's where dinosaurs live, is where imagination meets science.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that keep us, you know, going back to it, because there's always something new. I mean, there's always some amount of speculation there matching – it's where reality meets the best of what we can think of.
You know, it's interesting that one thing that's really personal in the book is not just the stories of when you were a kid wandering around the Natural History Museum, but this idea that the idea of evolution, the evolutionary success of dinosaurs, how they – the myth of what we think that they was – and we'll get into this, because I think this is really interesting, this idea that somehow we figured they were destined to be extinct. But you say if we can uncover the secret of that evolutionary success, maybe we can start to comprehend your fascination. So the idea of it being personal, the idea mm-hmm. of where humans fit in the evolutionary scheme mm-hmm. of things. Talk a little bit about that, because this is in some way it's this homage to the scientific method. It's this homage to evolution. I mean, it's bigger than just talking about dinosaurs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dinosaurs are where my sex is at in terms of science.
Yeah.
But I'm not really interested in whether, you know, the average person on the street, you know, knows the genus name, the latest dinosaur to be named or whatever. They're a great gateway drug for science and evolution and thinking about the deep past. And so they're this entree into these truths that we take for granted now, that, you know, things like extinction is reality, evolution is reality, the Earth has changed very, very much over a long span of time, and we're part of that history, things that scientists argued over for centuries trying to figure this out. And now it's just that accessible. And I think it's good to go back to the dinosaurs a bit and remember those lessons, because we've always held them up as kind of icons of extinction and icons of things that can go wrong. There's the phrase going the way of the dinosaur that you still hear now, and that's kind of coming out of these early 20th century ideas that they're just too big and stupid and sluggish to adapt. People would use it in terms of like business and stuff. So, you know, if you're a big business and you're just too big and you're too slow, then those nimble little – the business equivalent of those small mammals are going to overrun you and take over. That has kind of gone away, but the meme – stays with us, whereas now, you know, going the way of the dinosaur should mean feathery awesomeness. I mean, dinosaurs are still around. As I was, you know, waiting to come on the show, I saw little magpies hopping around on the lawn. Those are dinosaurs. Yeah. And if you watch them, you can really see it. You can see the velociraptor in them.
When you were a little kid, you said you wanted a pet dinosaur. But now you say – you confess that it feels a little strange to say that, because in some way – you're kind of glad dinosaurs are extinct. That's how you put it in the end. I want to ask you about that, because you rather like the idea of having to piece together this picture of dinosaurs mm-hmm. from what we have.
That's right. Yeah. That's part of the mystery of it, is that when you find these bones, even if you look at a skeleton in a museum, there are all these questions, the same ones that I encountered when I was a child. What did this animal look like? What color was it? What was its habitat like? What did it eat? How fast could it move? All these things sort of draw us out and make us ask, okay, especially in terms of time, like how long ago did this live? Okay, we put a date on it, but then that's also, you know, we're using ourselves as the baseline to gauge the rest of Earth history. So by, you know, something that's as small or might seem as trivial as, you know, what color was an Apatosaurus, yeah, by itself, that might seem just like, you know, more dinosauriana, more kid stuff. But you put all those different pieces together and you get an idea of how these animals evolved, how they actually lived and what their ecology was like. You start to get an idea or you can start to draw back and see the bigger picture. And certainly changes that are going on in the world now, things like climate change, invasive species. Dinosaurs were affected by those as well. And if we can understand, you know, all these little tidbits, put it together, understand how they were affected by things that we're still facing – you know, maybe we can get an idea of what the future is like. And if we knew everything about dinosaurs, if something like Triceratops was alive today, maybe they wouldn't seem as fascinating to us. Maybe we wouldn't be able to draw out those truths. Today things like zebras and lions and things on the African plains, they're these charismatic creatures that we still love them. We're still fascinated by them. But at the same time, they seem a little bit plain. They're familiar, you know. It's easy. We are only interested in them when they're really doing fierce or odd things. Whereas with dinosaurs, just the fact that they exist, just looking at one just stock still in a museum, fires our imagination in a much more powerful way. So in a way, I'm thankful that they're gone, because they draw us out. They make us ask questions about our planet and what it was like in the deep past.
I wanted to ask about so let's go back to the title Brontosaurus.
Yeah.
No such thing, really. It's a Apatosaurus.
That's right. Brontosaurus was struck from the scientific record books in 1903. So, you know, for over a century, there's been no such thing as a Brontosaurus anymore. I mean, the bones are real. I actually went to the Yale Peabody Museum and saw the bones of the one Brontosaurus not too long ago. But yes, it's properly called Apatosaurus now. And just for whatever reason, the old name, you know, stuck with us. It's a great name. Thunder lizard. You know, and like I said, seeing that skeleton for the first time, just imagining this dinosaur, like making it sound like rolling thunder as it walked across the plains. But, you know, sadly, we can't use it. It's been discarded. And it's kind of this hurtful reminder of this excellent name and this dinosaurian presence that's been replaced.
People get the title, right? Or do people chide you for it? I mean, do you get any of that? Do you know what
I've gotten a few. I think some people – well, people who've actually read the book get it. But there's people who are like, Brontës, well, why are you bringing this back? I mean, there is a very, very slim chance – I don't want to give anyone too much up. There's a very, very slim chance that Brontosaurus might be able to come back. There are a couple of skulls and some differences in its particular species from the other Apatosaurus species that exist. So if those are sufficiently different enough – the case could be made that Brontosaurus really does belong in a separate genus, and that name could be possibly revived. But you know whether that's going to happen or not, probably not. I think Apatosaurus is here to stay. But for the most part, I think people understand that this is more of celebrating a dinosaurian mascot. You know, sort of using
it's a mascot for the book, right?
Yeah. That you know, Brontosaurus is the epitome of dinosaurs as I encountered them as a child. And using that to show how far we've come in the past three decades in terms of science.
Because that – and this is what we'll get to when we get back from the break. That image of them as these – I keep coming back to the word clumsy, but lumbering and scaly and just dim-witted. Mm-hmm. That may be true, but do you know what I mean? That image of what we thought of when you encountered them at first, when I encountered them at first, and what they actually may have been – that's an important distinction. We'll get to that when we get back from a break. Brian Switek is with us, an online columnist for the National Geographic. His book is called My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Dinosaurs lived a long time ago. They were terrible lizards, don't you know? Some ate plants and some ate meat. Some ate fish and some ate beets. One was called a Diplodocus. One was bigger than your school bus. One was called a Triceratops. Three horns to stop anything it hops. Now, can't you just see yourself walking along, leading your pet Trachodon, or feeding your Brontosaurus Rex, or scratching your Diplodocus neck, or riding on a Stegosaurus back, or swimming in a Brachiosaurus track? Oh, what a time and oh, what fun playing tag with your Iguanodon.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science writer Brian Switek is with us to talk about dinosaurs. He writes about how our pop culture images of the dinosaurs are changing the more we learn. Turns out they weren't clumsy, lumbering beasts destined for extinction. They were complex and dynamic and more fuzzy than we thought. Switek's book is called My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. So let's talk about you say in the book, again, everything a dinosaur was supposed to be at the time was a Brontosaurus, big and scaly and shuffling and a swamp-dwelling hulk of a creature is how you put it. And that's what you mean by these sort of – that's our cultural – pop the pop culture image of a dinosaur, that it's a big – as you said, kind of lumbering,
well, the paleontologist,
graceless creature.
William Diller Matthew, who put up that Brontosaurus skeleton that I saw in the American Museum, he described it as just sort of this – animal automaton, just this animal that just couldn't do really anything else except wallow and eat and occasionally make baby dinosaurs, and that was all. And that was their entire reign. So paleontologists, especially of his era, during the early 20th century, looked at the sort of reign of the dinosaurs as this evolutionary interlude that was, great as soon as it was over. Just, the mammals are waiting in the wings to take over, and just, evolution is directionless. It's not like, this was intentional, but just that it was this long sort of, nightmare of idiotic reptiles, swimming around swamps, whereas, things really got interesting with the mammals was their perspective.
Yeah. This idea that – and somehow there was a line, there was a progression in evolution, that it was headed toward us.
Oh, yeah. And that's something that goes back to the 19th century. I mean, it's kind of odd because, as much as we credit, Charles Darwin today, at the time, people didn't really like his idea that evolution didn't have an endpoint and that it was, undirected in the big picture sort of sense. A lot of people came up with these alternate ideas that, evolution had this sort of internal driving mechanisms, things that fall under the rubric of what was often called orthogenesis, where there was some kind of plan or progression. And that dovetailed with a lot of people who were unsettled by the sort of religious implications of evolution. We could still believe that we were the ultimate end point of this process. We know that's not true. But I mean, the way that dinosaurs fit into that, I mean, people thought about sort of what they called senescence, so that if you looked at our favorite dinosaurs, things like Triceratops or Stegosaurus, whatever, they're getting so spiky and scaly because they're investing all their energy in growing large and getting body armor and stuff, so they had less energy to devote to like vital forces inside them, and they've evolved themselves into extinction. But if you believe that, then why did they exist for millions and millions of years? Why were they so successful? I mean, people brought this up where they said, okay, they went extinct because they got too scaly and they got too big. But then again, we see multiple forms like popping up over time and dominating the Earth. So they understood the contradiction, didn't get it. Finally, now we understand that, no, this isn't a directed sort of thing. Yeah. Dinosaurs were incredibly lucky in a lot of respects.
Yeah. And successful. They were successful. Absolutely. 200 million years they existed.
Yeah, and still with us.
Yeah, exactly. So the so let's talk about the impression versus reality.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be agile, some of them. I mean, the bigger ones, I mean, agile in relative terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They didn't move like we thought they did. They were far more dynamic.
Yeah. The one that really made the difference was an animal called Deinonychus. And John Ostrom, who's a Yale paleontologist, found this animal in Montana in 1969. And paleontologists had toyed with this idea of smaller dinosaurs being relatively active and agile before. But this was the animal that really changed everything for dinosaurs. This was the archetype for the Velociraptor in Jurassic Park. And actually, it was the Velociraptor in Jurassic Park probably should have been called Deinonychus. There's a little taxonomic reshuffling that happened when Michael Crichton was writing his book that he just changed the name because it sounds better, I guess. But it's this animal. It's about our size, human-sized dinosaur more or less, had these switchblade claws on its feet, a long tail that was supported by these bony processes that came off that made the tail really long and really stiff. And Ostrom looked at this dinosaur and said, there's no way that this could be a cold-blooded, sluggish, tail-dragging animal. Just anatomically, it didn't work. And, and that really was the spark that set off that what paleontologists call the dinosaur renaissance, this sort of investigation into, are they warm-blooded or cold-blooded? How fast could they move? There are a lot of image changes that happen, and now we're really extending beyond that. We're really starting to investigate some of the questions that period brought up. So now we can finally get some clues. Okay, when did dinosaurs start mating? How fast did they actually grow? How could they actually move? It's this sort of melding of old bones and new technologies. There's allowing us to draw more information out from bones than ever before. And that's what's really causing this major, image shift from, what we expected before, just putting the skeletons together as best we thought.
Right.
And now getting better ideas about how they actually lived.
Have a sense of what they did sound like? I mean, you were trying to imagine what that Brontosaurus sounded like. What do you think?
It's really tough because, I mean, we've got modern dinosaurs. We have birds, but they sing and make noises through a very specialized sort of vocal tract called a syrinx that, as far as we know, dinosaurs, they're non-avian dinosaurs, didn't have.
Right.
Whereas we've got alligators and crocodiles, which are the other sort of bracket. So they're the closest living cousins to the whole dinosaur group. And they make sounds that sort of sound like a lawnmower starting to a drain becoming unplugged, these deep rumbles and bellows and things like that. That might have been closer to what a lot of dinosaurs sounded like. There's only a few that we can get a good idea of what they did sound like, though, because of their head crests. So you have these shovel-beaked hadrosaurs, something like Parasaurolophus. You see it in many museums, had this long hollow tube crest sticking out of the back of its head. And paleontologists such as David Weisampel have actually reconstructed this just with PVC pipe and blown through this. And it sounds kind of like a foghorn or like, a semi-truck horn. And this isn't just playing around with toys. Basically, he went and did CT scans of the dinosaur ears, and they had middle ears that seemed to be attuned to that kind of sound range, these low-frequency, booming kind of calls. Not unlike what elephants do today to communicate with each other over long distances, these low rumbles that we might not be able to hear, but they can hear and actually pick up through the pads of their feet. So for some dinosaurs, we can reconstruct the sound. But other ones, it's probably going to remain in the realm of imagination.
Do you imagine it was noisy?
At times, during the mating season, I think so.
Yeah.
Especially for these dinosaurs. I mean, they seem to have, you know, based upon their brains and on trackways that show social behavior, at least a number of these seem to be relatively social animals. So you can imagine sort of, you know, 76 million years ago. Parasaurolophus is a dinosaur that's actually found in Utah. So back when Utah was shorefront property, there's this seaway that extended through the middle of the country, and southern Utah was more like a bayou in Louisiana than the deserts that we have now. Imagining these, you know, enormous crested herbivores, you know, in the Cretaceous twilight, just calling out to each other over long distances, you know, looking for a suitable mate, trying to impress each other. Yeah, I think during those times it could have been quite noisy.
Let's talk about dinosaur sex, because you write about that. You say to understand how it worked, we have to go to birds or crocodiles.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And one of the questions, let's just say it, you sort of get at is, did dinosaurs have penises?
That's right. Yeah. It's that. I mean, you need to know what equipment you're working with if you're going to figure out the mechanics of this process. And it, to me, that's a great way to talk about evolution, how we kind of come up with expectations or hypotheses about what existed in the past when we don't have direct evidence. I mean, unfortunately, nobody has found a fossilized impression or fossilized you know, dinosaur member as yet. If somebody does, that's a nature cover story right there. That, I mean, yeah. I might hang up my head like dinosaurs are done now. Like it's great. So if we look at crocodiles, like living alligators and crocodiles, like I said, they're the closest cousins to the entire you know, dinosaur family, and the males have a phallus.
Yeah.
And if we look at birds, many birds don't, but that seems to be a specialized state. If we look at the birds at the bottom of the family tree, the most archaic birds living today, things like ostriches and waterfowl and tinamous, they have the same male reproductive anatomy.
Right.
So by looking at that bracket, if crocs do and if archaic birds do, that means this is probably a trait that goes back to their last common ancestor, and that includes dinosaurs, non-avian dinosaurs fall within that bracketing. So, you know, no one has found direct evidence of this yet, but by using this evolutionary logic, we can come up with these expectations. It's the same reason as why if you see a restoration of one like early humans, like Lucy, or, you know, this Australopithecus afarensis, and
right.
You know, they depict her with, you know, a fine matting of hair. No early human skeleton has ever been found
right.
with body hair, but because we know that she's a mammal, we know she's a primate, you know, must have been there. So even if we were wrong in a few particulars, by understanding the evolutionary tree and the distribution of these kinds of traits, we can come up with good hypotheses and then go from there into the biology. So in terms of dinosaur sex, once we have the equipment, we can start to try and get an idea about how this actually worked. I mean, dinosaurs figured it out, but we have to sort of reverse engineer this over 66 million years later.
You say dinosaurs lived fast and died young.
That's right. Yeah. Research done at the University of California, Berkeley by a friend of mine, Sarah Werning, and her colleague, Andrew Lee, they looked inside dinosaur bone. They cut into this, into the microstructure. And when dinosaurs were pregnant, when they're laying eggs, they laid down a very specific bone tissue inside their long bones. Birds do this too, called medullary bone. So if you find this particular kind of bone tissue, you know you've got a pregnant female dinosaur. And they paired that.
That was a huge finding, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the first time we can actually tell the sex of some dinosaurs, at least. Not every dinosaur, right. But if this tissue is present, you know, we know we've got a female. And that's major, because for years, paleontologists have been trying to figure this out, and they couldn't. So they paired this with studies of how old the dinosaurs were by looking at these bands in their bone called lines of arrested growth. Mm. And they figured out that these dinosaurs were basically teenagers when they were pregnant and when they died. So the Tyrannosaurus rex was 18. I think the Allosaurus was somewhere on the order of about like 10 or 12 years old. And there was another herbivorous dinosaur that they found this in called Tenontosaurus that was about 8 years old or so. And all these dinosaurs were still rapidly growing when they died. So in terms of their life history, it looks like they had to start reproducing very early in their lives, or else they weren't going to leave any offspring. And most dinosaurs that we have are in this juvenile to subadult sort of range. We don't have very many infants, and we don't have very many at all of the oldest individuals. So most, it looked like if you were a dinosaur and you wanted to pass on your genes to the next generation, not like they were thinking this, but in terms of the evolutionary calculus.
Get cracking.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons for their success, is that's one of the reasons they're able to outcompete our relatives, is that our cousins and ancestors seem to grow more slowly, have smaller, you know, internal sort of gestation for a while. Dinosaurs are able to just pop those eggs out really rapidly and just fill up the world much faster than our predecessors.
A typical Tyrannosaurus, I'll just say that, because that's another iconic beast.
Yeah.
What would the life expectancy have been? Do you have a beast like that? Any idea?
People have calculated life tables for this for Tyrannosaurus based upon the specimens that have been found. That's actually a great dinosaur to pick because we've got over 50 skeletons and various other pieces. So that might not seem like very much. But in terms of dinosaur sample size, it's actually pretty good. It seems about like 30 years old or so would be the oldest a Tyrannosaurus rex would get. But many of them died much, much before that when they were still in their teens or their early 20s. Probably
– Do we know?
That's the big question. Yeah, in individual case, it's often hard to tell, but there are a few clues. If a tyrannosaur, say, kills another tyrannosaur, you'd expect to see crushing bite bone damage of the sort. As far as I know, that hasn't been found. But the weirdest thing, and something that's recently figured out, is in the Tyrannosaurus rex Sioux that's on display in the Field Museum in Chicago and a few other specimens, there are these really weird holes in the lower jaw. It looks like someone took like a shotgun and blasted this dinosaur in the mouth, more or less. And for a while, people thought that this was a bite, that this was evidence of like cannibalism or this antagonistic behavior. Turns out you see the same holes in the jaws of modern birds, things like hawks and other raptors. And it's caused by a microorganism that basically it takes up inside the in pigeons, and when the hawks eat those pigeons, it infests the upper digestive tracts of these birds of prey, and it creates ulcers and lesions and bores into the bone. And it's basically identical in the tyrannosaurs. So tyrannosaurs were afflicted by something that still afflicts birds today. So you have in Sue's case, you have one of the largest tyrannosaurs ever found, one of the most formidable predators ever to have evolved on the face of the earth. Probably died of starvation because of a microorganism that you couldn't even see with the naked eye. So this is Cretaceous CSI. We can't always tell in each individual case, but in some cases where there are enough clues, we can sort of piece back together what happened to these dinosaurs.
The question you write a little bit about how for the Tyrannosaurus rex, the question of whether or not it was a hunter or a scavenger.
Yeah.
And I guess the answer is probably both.
That's right. I mean, this was more of a sort of media thing than a real scientific question. In 1993, paleontologist Jack Horner gave a talk just putting this idea out there. And it had been forwarded before very early on, like the late 19th century. And people were just taking this like, are you saying that, my Tyrannosaurus rex like couldn't have hunted anything? People were aghast at this possibility. And there's no real science to this. This is just saying, okay, well, look at how small the arms are and look at how small the eyes are and look how big the jaws are. This is something that, had a crushing bite, not like a slicing bite. So therefore, maybe it was an obligate scavenger. But, even today, there's no animal that feeds entirely, no large predatory animal, or I shouldn't say predatory, no large carnivorous animal that gets all of its food through scavenging. And even like the classic examples that you might think of as a scavenger, like a spotted hyena, another animal that it doesn't have, it's not taking things down with its arms like a lion does. It has only using its skull, crushing kind of bite. There are populations that get 95% or more of their meat through hunting. So in terms of Tyrannosaurus rex, it was probably both hunter and scavenger. And there's actual fossil evidence that corroborates this. I mean, you find bite marks on the hips of Triceratops or on the bones of some of these hadrosaurs. And in that case, you can't really tell why the animal died. You just can tell that, something was feeding on it. It could be scavenging. It could have been brought down through predation. But the thing that clinches hunting are injuries. So, injured bones on the backs of some of these hadrosaurs that, show a bite wound that could have only been made by a Tyrannosaurus rex. It was the only animal
something
large enough to do it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And because this tyrannosaur failed, then we know that they're actually hunters, because its prey survived long enough, at least until to heal a little bit and then get into the fossil record.
So what's your image? I know what, the sort of common image is. Mm-hmm. It's the beast that ate the lawyer in Jurassic Park, right? I mean, so what's your impression of a T-Rex?
Something much fuzzier than that. I mean, the Jurassic Park Tyrannosaurus was quite close, actually. It's probably the best, Tyrannosaurus has ever been on the big screen. I mean, some things like vision based on movement and stuff is just absolute nonsense. But in terms of the form of the animal, much more modern, much, much better, much more accurate. But it needs a coat of fuzzy feathers. And people don't really like that when I bring it up because it grates against this childhood image of these scabrous, monstrous animals. But and direct evidence of fuzziness on Tyrannosaurus hasn't been found to date, but it's this, going back to this evolutionary logic. So there are two Tyrannosaurs, one very small and one rather large, over 30 feet long. They've been found with feathery fuzz. And Tyrannosaurs in general belong to this bigger group of dinosaurs called Celurosaurs. It also includes things like Velociraptor, things like Oviraptor, this major, major group of theropod dinosaurs. And every single lineage in that has some kind of fluff or fuzz or feather. So there seems to be something – rather than evolving independently over and over and over, something that goes back to their last common ancestor. So even in cases within this group, if there's not direct evidence for feathers, either, you know, preserved next to them or quill knobs on the bones or something, we can make a good case that these animals were fluffy and fuzzy. And the argument to me, it seems to be just, you're making my dinosaur look stupid. Like, I don't want it to look like a giant bird. It's going to look like Big Bird is the thing they hear most often.
Yeah.
And people, you know, sometimes draw just rather dumb illustrations to go along with this. But when done right, when done, you know, scientifically accurately, Tyrannosaurus looks just as majestic and fearsome as ever. And really, you know, if you found yourself in the Cretaceous and you saw a fuzzy Tyrannosaurus and you stopped to laugh at it, you'd just be giving it a head start, you know, when it came after
you. But it is so funny that we have these preconceived notions and they're hard to get rid of.
Absolutely. I mean, the dinosaurs that we meet when we're children, I think, really stick with us. You know, when I started writing this book, I was talking to my father about it, and he was like, "Oh, they're just big lizards, right?" And that's something that's like was even before my generation. That's something, that's what he encountered when he was a child back in the 50s. They kind of just latch on to our brains and don't let go. But kids now, I mean, kids now are totally on board with feathery dinosaurs and all the latest discoveries. And it kind of makes me wonder, what are they going to be getting upset about in 20 years' time about, you know, when science continues to change dinosaurs? So we're not even close to done. We're not even close to finding all the dinosaurs yet. I mean, about 500 or so valid genera have been named. But, you know, estimates based upon like the number of rock formations there are and just places that haven't been sort of plumbed yet and the average number of dinosaurs in formation, using that kind of math, it's estimated that there are over 1,800 different varieties of non-avian dinosaurs over their 160-year sort of dominant period, 160 million year, I'm sorry, dominant period. So we're not even close to – we're not even halfway yet to even finding them, much less answering questions about their biology or evolution. So really, I mean, there's no better time for paleontology than now. We're still at the very beginning.
Brian Switek is with us. His book is called My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. And we'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with science writer Brian Switek. We're talking about his book, My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. So let's say this, and I was going to ask you this earlier, but you know, you're from Central Jersey.
That's right.
Did you really come to Utah to be closer to dinosaurs?
Yeah, there were two reasons. Number one, I'm a freelance science writer, and the cost of living in Utah is about half of what it was in New Jersey. So, you know, the price is right. But the main reason was for the dinosaurs. Yeah. I mean, this is Dinosaur Central. And the great thing about Utah is that it was kind of passed over during the classic bone rush eras. Like, you know, off Neil Charles Marsh passed through Utah. He picked up a couple of teeth. Is this, you know, one of these paleontologists involved in this great scientific dispute over dinosaurs in the late 19th century. But really, that was about all people did. They just kind of passed on through. They maybe picked up a couple of bones. But now, I mean, we've got sites all over the state. I mean, you can drive, you know, anywhere from, you know, 2 to 5 hours and come to amazing dinosaur sites. I was actually just out in the field with the Natural History Museum of Utah field crew in Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And that place in particular is just so over-rich in bone. I mean, I imagine what it would have been like if these early bone hunters had come there first and how our image of dinosaurs might have been different if they're finding these like even stranger animals. I mean, there are several that have been named, a few that are on their way to press, and even more probably that haven't even been found yet. It's just an absolute gold mine in paleontology. And one of the really, you know, just classic places, like Dinosaur National Monument, that's where the skull of Apatosaurus was finally found. It was lost for about – or at least mislabeled for about 70 years. Mm. And I didn't really think about it at the time, but it made the move all the more perfect. It's, you know, the beginning of the end for Brontosaurus started in Utah.
Wow. So what's it like in the field? You write about going to Montana to this Hell Creek formation.
Yeah.
And at various points in the book, you write about how you need, you know, a certain level of concentration and focus. You write this in the book. You say a momentary break in attention can make all the difference between spotting a piece of dinosaur and stepping on it.
That's right. It's hard to keep that kind of concentration because in some ways it can be a little bit tedious. I mean, you're just walking all day or you're digging all day finding nothing. But it could be just that 1 second that you're not paying attention, that you drive your pick through a bone or you step on something. So it's a matter of having the right search image, you know, knowing what the bone in the area looks like and just scanning for it, but also just keeping enough attention without, you know, blowing out your own brain, right, basically from concentrating far too hard.
Get lost in the moment? I mean, I know for people who have affections for, you know, painting or woodworking or something like that. Is that this thing for you?
Yeah. I mean, especially when I'm working on a bone or I found a bone or uncovered it. I mean, when you've got it, I mean, people often tell me, especially when they see me prepping bone in the lab at our museum in town, you know, oh, that must be so tedious. It must be so boring. It's really not, because with every little speck of rock that you take off, you see a little bit more and you start to get a better idea. Okay, what is this bone? Where did it fit in the skeleton? How big was this animal? And there are all those persistent questions about the animal's life that come out of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's easy. Once you've found the bone, it's easy to get quite lost. Otherwise, it's a lot of time, you know, hiking. Whether it's sort of like gambling in a way. You know, you don't know whether you're going to strike it rich or get totally skunked. And I guess that's part of the allure. If you get reinforced just often enough with a good find, it keeps you coming back.
You talk about looking for – just sort of looking for maybe the glint of a piece of enamel, for example.
Yeah.
It's got to be cool finding a tooth, right? I mean
– yeah.
Or are you more excited about something else?
Teeth and bone, Arnie, it really depends on what site you're actually at. I mean, some sites, like the ones I was just at, you find, you know, large bones everywhere. And a lot of times it's quite frustrating because these bones will be exploded by erosion and wind and rain. If you like, oh, if I'd just been here like a week ago, this bone would have been perfect. But, you've lost it. For me, it's not so much trackways. It's more tooth and bone sort of stuff. And there's some places like microsites. So these are sites where you're not going to get a big skeleton, but there are a lot of like small fossils, fish vertebrae, teeth, little itty bitty things. And that's one of the places I went to when I was in Hell Creek, Montana.
Right.
And, you know, I found a bunch of dinosaur teeth, and that was pretty neat, but everybody was finding them. To me, the big find there was part of a small mammal's upper jaw with two teeth inside it. And, you know, it turns out that this came from a marsupial, so not one of my direct ancestors. I don't have a pouch. But, you know, an ancient mammalian relative. And it just really brought home the fact, our cousins and ancestors were running around at the same time, you know, for millions and millions of years with dinosaurs, and just have that, you know, really deep connection to the past. That's my favorite find from out there.
Let's go to the phones. Lorraine is with us in Salt Lake. Lorraine, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
My question is to our guest is, have they thought, I'm sure they have, but what's the hypothesis of what the feathers were for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, feathers evolved millions and millions of years before flight. And through finding a lot of these feathery dinosaurs, paleontologists and ornithologists have been able to figure out sort of how feathers evolved, that they started out as these really simple tube-like fuzzy things, almost like down on a baby chick. And then they started branching from there, you know, branched off a little bit more, got a central vein. So we actually have a pretty good evolutionary idea of how feathers showed up. But I mean, most times, like Velociraptor, we know from quill knobs on one of its arm bones that it had the equivalent of flight feathers that you might see on a turkey vulture or a raven. And this animal was not flying. It was not aerodynamic. It's about as aerodynamic as a brick.
Right.
So why didn't it have it? Yeah. Well, for insulation, for display, and possibly in sort of convergence with modern day birds of prey, that it was pinning down prey with its sickle claw and flapping as it was trying to kill these animals. So rather than like going after large animals, it would be chasing after small mammals and other things, pinning it down, flapping its wings in order to keep that prey down long enough to kill it and then eat it. So dinosaurs were doing bird-like things before they even took to the air.
Lorraine, thanks. Dan is with us in Salt Lake. Dan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
My question is, I love dinosaurs for one thing. When I was a kid, I had pictures taken with Paul Sereno and Jack Horner and Jim Jensen. So I've always loved dinosaurs. And I really want to know what the opinion is among paleontologists when they talk amongst themselves about, because for me it seems that paleontology is kind of a different brand of science, because there's so much that we have to infer and basically imagine about these animals, since we don't know their behavior, we don't know the soft parts, most often than not, don't fossilize except for, you know, in the, you know, formation in China where we're getting the very volcanically preserved birds and soft tissues. But what's the opinion on the limit we can learn about these animals? Because there is a limit, because we can't understand everything, because we don't have the animal in front of us. I wonder what the opinion among paleontologists when they talk about this most themselves. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, there certainly is a limit on what we can know. We were talking about sound earlier in the program.
Yeah.
Without the sort of soft tissues, we can't really know unless there's some other sort of structure that would have made sound like some of these crests. So there are obviously limits. But at the same time, I think paleontologists try very hard not to sort of demarcate, okay, what we can never know. As a kid, I was told we never know what dinosaur color was. But now, through the discovery of feathery dinosaurs and technology to actually look at the microstructure of those feathers and compare those to modern birds, where we know sort of these little bodies called melanosomes help create color. So if we can look at the sort of melanosome distribution in a modern bird feather and figure, okay, that distribution makes black, and find that same distribution in a dinosaur feather, we can figure out dinosaur color. I mean, for years I was told we'd never ever do this, and now we finally have a way that's opening up all these new questions. It goes back to a Charles Darwin quote. It's those who know little, not those who know much, who say this or that problem will never be solved by science. So there are some things, yes, that are probably beyond the range of what we can actually get at in terms of, you know, soft tissues or certain aspects of their biology. But the general feeling that I get from talking to paleontologists is that, you know, you don't want to say we're never going to get there.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what the next, you know, fossil finder, next development technology will allow us to understand about dinosaur lives.
Imagine 20 years from now, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's
like and maybe even identifying a color or finding some impression, some fossilized impression of something that says it sounded like this or looked like this, or you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a way of thinking about fossils as time capsules, not just as these static objects, but, you know, remnants of living animals that we can draw secrets from if we know the right questions to ask.
Dan, thanks very much. There are a lot of dinosaur mysteries you write about. And you say in the book one of the most confounding is that there are no descendants of Tyrannosaurus or Triceratops living today. And this is one of the reasons you go to Montana, which we had talked about. But I want to have you read this section in the book. Because we just don't know what happened to the Triceratops, for example. And there's this moment in this section where you imagine this solitary Triceratops, one of the last of its kind, you say, kind of alone there and maybe even confused. I thought it was a nice image. Read this section for us, would you?
Sure. Rain and wind had already done the hard work. Erosion had winnowed the fossils out of the soft sediment and left them all over the ground. Dinosaur teeth were the easiest to find. In an hour of collecting, I had picked up the isolated fang of a small Tyrannosaurus, a Triceratops tooth, and a few slightly curved teeth that belonged to the feathery, sickle-clawed Deinonychosaurs. I found a flat spot to sit down and inspected the vestiges of dinosaurian lives long gone. Even though their avian cousins would survive, even thrive in the millennia to come, every existing lineage of non-avian dinosaurs simply blinked out of existence. Not a single one was spared. It's impossible to know who turned the lights out at the end of the Cretaceous world. We just don't have the geological resolution to piece together the final moments of that unfortunate creature. But sitting on the fossil-rich hill, I imagine Triceratops as the final holdout. After all, the hulking three-horned herbivore is more common than any other type of dinosaur in these deposits. You can hardly spend a day in the Hell Creek Formation without stumbling across some remnant of a Triceratops skull. So technically, they had the strength in numbers in the face of extinction, and could have been the species that defied extinction the longest. Turning over the single Triceratops tooth in my hand, just one component of the prodigious Ceratopsian, I envision an old solitary dinosaur standing in the Cretaceous twilight. One of her horns is broken, and her face is scarred with signs of a hard life in the land of tyrannosaurs. The terminal member of her species, she holds a lonely vigil as the horizon swallows the sun and the Cretaceous closes. Or maybe, I think, that last Triceratops is a younger animal, confused that his herd has disappeared. He mournfully hoots into the dark night, waiting to hear a return call that never comes. Tearing up a little bit, actually reading that.
I think that's amazing that you're tearing up. I think that's so lovely, Brian. That is so cool. I mean, you have this – I mean, you really are connected to this stuff.
Well, yeah, I just imagine how lonely that would be. I mean, obviously these dinosaurs wouldn't think the same way that we do. But, no. Be that last animal and have no idea. Just know that your herd is gone. Not have the reign of your kind be over. Yeah. Have no conception that it slipped away.
There's an important lesson that you say you've learned over time, and it's that we desperately need to keep dinosaurs in mind as we watch our world change around us.
Absolutely.
Say something about that if you would, finally, because it's an important message you have in the book.
Yeah, I mean, we often looked at dinosaurs as sort of icons of extinction and, in terms of, going the way of the dinosaur or, when the asteroid impact hypothesis came out and scientists like Carl Sagan looked at it as an equivalent of nuclear winter, what that might do to us. So we've always kind of looked at them for these morality fables and then said, well, because they disappeared, we could finally thrive. Their absence made our existence possible. But the opposite is also true,
right,
is that they, ruled the world for so long. Our ancestors and cousins lived alongside them. They shaped our evolution. So we both needed the presence and the absence of dinosaurs for us to even be here. If dinosaurs never existed, we might not be here discussing them either. And by realizing that and realizing that, these are animals that thrived for so long and were affected by, forces that are still in action today in terms of, the continent shifting around, climate change, invasive species. If we can get some of these big picture questions, if we can, sort of check off these various aspects of their biology that might seem trivial, put those together, get this big picture, maybe we can start to form expectations about what the future is going to be like, especially since we now know that we're changing the planet in, catastrophic ways. We haven't even started to see sort of the products of what we're, doing right now. But by going into the past and seeing how animals have reacted to what we're doing, maybe we can draw out some secrets for our own survival in the future.
I want to say something finally about the book, the jacket cover on the book.
Yeah.
It's a poster.
That's right. Yeah, it's a double-sided poster. I didn't know I was going to be on it, and they told me Mark Stutzman, who did the artwork, he had done the Elvis stamp and does covers for Mad Magazine. And when they told me that, it's like, I'm not going to be like a caricature or something, am I? But he did a fantastic job just bringing this animal to life.
And that's what it's about, right? I mean, for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And on the one side, it's me feeding, my favorite dinosaur a bouquet of flowers. On the other side, it's a skeleton. And that's, sort of what I imagine when I go to these museums. I look at the bones and it's like, what would it be like to be on that ancient floodplain? I still love it.
Brian Sweetick, his book is called My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.